So in last class we first studied what is chaos, like briefly. So and in that I had mentioned, or maybe I did not explicitly, that chaos happens like in bounded systems, and there can be systems where your phase space is unbounded, but like there can be energy values for which your phase space remains bounded. So chaos can only happen in bounded systems. Like if there is unstable behavior in unbounded systems, we do not call that chaos. Second property is aperiodicity. So chaotic trajectories are always aperiodic. And third condition we already talked about was sensitivity to initial conditions. The system must exhibit sensitivity to initial conditions. So we can discuss like what happens. Suppose if only these two are satisfied, but this is not satisfied. Can you think of any example? Any system in which your phase space may be bounded, or you can restrict your system to that, but there is no sensitivity to initial condition.
Enharmonic oscillator.
So yeah, like if the frequencies of the different oscillators, you mean n uncoupled harmonic oscillators?
Some perturbation in harmonic oscillator, which is not periodic, but
Yeah, so like for example, if we consider two uncoupled harmonic oscillator together, and if the ratio of their frequencies is irrational, then on the torus, the behavior will be aperiodic, right? And the system is bounded, but there is no sensitivity to initial condition, so you cannot have chaos there. So that's a right example. Like if we have condition 1 and 2 and not condition 3, like a system of two uncoupled harmonic oscillators. Frequencies whose ratio is irrational. If it is rational, then it will turn out to be periodic, right? So basically, quasi-periodic motion. Any example where you have aperiodicity and sensitivity to initial condition, but the system is not bounded? Just some mathematical system you can think of, very simple. Not like going to. You have condition 2 and 3, but not one.
Maybe the weather, because who knows if it's really bound.
So like, yeah, in general, like if you talk about specifically, for example, Lorentz model, which is a weather model, the system is dissipative, so that system, I guess, it is bound to be bounded. But in general, like you can construct models of weather where maybe not. If your system is dissipative, then I guess everywhere, then your system is going to be bounded, I suppose. And I don't know if there exist weather models which are not dissipative. I'll give a simple example, like it's just you can have, as I had briefly said last time, that linear systems cannot have chaos. So just some 1D system, for example, which is this is some just 1D system, suppose, not a Hamiltonian system, just some 1D system. So if you solve this, you will get x is equal to some constant e to the power 2t, right? So this is exponential. So if you will calculate sensitivity to initial conditions, like calculate Lyapunov exponent value here, you will see that it will come out to be 2 actually here. But this is not bounded, right? X will grow infinitely here, like keep on growing. That is unbounded, and x is not going to come back to itself, so it is aperiodic in that sense. Does that make sense? So, and like there is a fixed point here, which is x dot equals to 0. If we set, then we get x star equals to 0, right? So the fixed point is unstable. So linear systems can have unstable fixed point, for example, and unstable fixed points have positive Lyapunov exponents. So that implies there is sensitivity to initial conditions, at least at the unstable fixed point. But there is no boundedness, so we don't talk about chaos there. And last, what if your system is bounded and has sensitivity to initial condition but is not aperiodic? For this, you can consider, for example, an integrable system, for example, a simple pendulum. For a simple pendulum, you have an unstable fixed point. Like a simple pendulum has 2 fixed points. You start your system at this point, like it will stay there forever, right? Sorry?
We take the inverted point like
this. Yeah, so this is a stable fixed point, and the other fixed point is this one, that if you can exactly place it here without any momentum, then it is supposed to be there, at least mathematically you will see that. But if you perturb it even infinitesimally, it will like go away from this fixed point, right? So this is an unstable fixed point. So like here at this unstable fixed point, since it stays there, you can say that it is like aperiodic. So it can have, it is a bounded system, and it has sensitivity to initial condition at the unstable fixed point, but overall your simple pendulum is a periodic system, right? So that is the third example. So just briefly describing some properties of chaos that I had thought to describe it last day but forgot. So next, towards the end of last lecture, I was saying that if you have an integrable system, integrable systems with n degrees of freedom, what is the dimension of the phase space? Yeah. So if you have an integrable system, the dynamics of any initial condition is restricted to an n-dimensional hypersurface. That's what I mentioned in the end of last lecture, but I guess it is not so intuitive. So I thought to discuss that a bit. So we'll discuss this using using the central force problem, where your potential is where your potential is only a function of the radial distance between the two bodies. And for a specific case of gravitation, this potential equals, can anyone tell what is, as a function, what is the function of R? Or yeah,
it's like GMM, right? Okay,
GMM over R. So, and if it is attractive, so minus, I guess, right? So that's right. So for the specific case of gravitation, your potential is minus k by R. This is one example, but you can have any function of R here in central force problem in general. If you have this specific gravitation potential, then there are extra symmetries in the system, and that that you have worked out in the tutorial, hidden symmetries. But beyond, like any other function of R, that hidden symmetries may not be there, but there are still some symmetries, as we had like briefly just discussed last week also. So like we can write the Hamiltonian for this case to be mod of the momentum vector. Right. So in general, what are the constants of motion? Does anyone remember?
Energy, angular momentum.
Yeah, energy, angular momentum.
Strong lens, vector.
So that vector is only, that is this hidden symmetry. This is only for this potential. I am talking about general potential. So overall, in a Hamiltonian, like it is a time independent system, so obviously energy is a constant of motion. But like apart from that, angular momentum vector is a constant of motion. So the intuitive way to think, like you can prove it using Noether's theorem, because there is rotational symmetry in the system. You can prove it using Poisson brackets, the Poisson bracket of H comma any like component of L is going to be zero. But just from Newtonian point of view, you can also think about it as the torque on the system is zero. So if there is no torque on the system, then angular momentum is conserved, right? Just from Newtonian mechanics, in the sense that you remember torque is equal to R cross F. And the force here is along the radial direction, because the potential is in the radial direction. So force is also in the radial direction. So these two become parallel for central force problem. So that will imply that torque is zero. And if if there is no torque in the system, that would imply that angular momentum vector is a constant for that system. Is that clear? I mean, feel free to ask questions. I understand it's morning, so it feels like everyone is dull today, unlike last day. But feel free to ask questions. I try to keep the class interactive to make sure that, yeah, at least people are understanding.
Wait, so what was the third constant of motion? We have angular momentum, energy, and what was the last one?
So angular momentum vector is a constant of motion. That implies angular momentum along any direction is a constant of motion.
Oh, okay. So is energy a constant of motion? Or?
Yeah. So your Hamiltonian is time independent, right? So anything is a constant of motion. What does it imply? The time derivative of it is going to be zero, right? That is a constant of motion. So whenever your Hamiltonian is time independent, dH by dt is zero. So that implies energy is a constant of motion. Yeah.
I get why the angular momentum vector is constant, but I'm confused because I remember L square and L sin were constants.
So, like, people take only two of, like, technically any angular momentum vector is constant in any direction, but you have to specifically take a, like a few of them to solve the problems. You don't need in every direction. You don't need to take it in every direction. And we'll discuss that why. Like we had discussed for integrability, in integrability definitions, there were n constants of motion and the constants of motion need to satisfy the Poisson bracket relation, right? That if Fi's are constants of motion, suppose, then these Fi's needed to satisfy these criteria, like they must be in involution. I had just stated this in the last class. So now you should take those, like to prove integrability, for example, we should only consider those components which Poisson commute. So Lx and Ly obviously will not Poisson commute, right? Is that clear? Like the class, calculation of Poisson commutation of Lx and Ly or any two angular momentum component is slightly long. But you can think about it in, from quantum mechanics, for example. There is a correspondence between commutators in quantum mechanics and Poisson bracket relations in classical mechanics, right? So if anyone remembers what is the commutator of Lx and Ly?
It's like I something. Is there like an H?
Sorry, I?
There's like an I and an LZ.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Right. So likewise, if you take any two, I should. Sorry. Yeah. I was mentioning quantum mechanical commutators. This is what you get, right? So like, but if you take commutator between L square comma LZ, what is this?
Yeah.
Yeah. Or if you take any component, just one component, it will be zero, right? It is not just LZ. It's just that you can choose whenever angular momentum is constant, like you can choose whichever, which direction you want to like position your reference frame in. So we generally do this for convenience. But technically, any of them you can choose. But you can't choose this pair, right? Like, you can't choose two components because they never commute in quantum mechanics or Poisson commute in classical mechanics.
So why is this an integrable system if the constraints of motion they don't have zero Poisson vector?
So we have, so this is a 3 degree of freedom system, right? The central force problem, r theta phi, 3 degrees of freedom. And we have 3 constants of motion, right? Which Poisson commutes. So take L square, LZ, and Hamiltonian. We have 3 constants of motion which Poisson commute with each other. That's how it is integrable. So we'll try to understand why in the central force problem, not just gravitational force, central force problem, the dynamics of the system will be restricted to the 3-dimensional hypersurface or 3-dimensional manifold in the 6-dimensional phase space. the phase space in this case comprises of these six. I mean, you can choose polar coordinates or Cartesian coordinates. I'll just explain here in Cartesian coordinates. So this is the fixed dimensional phase space, right? Now, what is vector L in terms of vector R and vector P? R cross P, yeah. So using this, you can compute the components using that cross product. L square is equal to, can you speak speak a bit loudly? It should feel like there are 25 students in the class. Currently it feels like there are 2 or 3 students in the class. So now suppose we overall let us examine just this set of constants of motion. H is a constant of motion, right? L square is also, and we can say that all these are constants of motion for the center force problem. So let AX be the set of such that the x component of angular momentum is some fixed value Lx naught, suppose. And likewise, Ay is the set such that Ly is Ly naught is I'm taking any arbitrary real value, Lx naught, Ly naught, Lz naught, and so if we take L equals to Lx naught, for example, that will imply Ypz minus Zpy is equal to Lx naught, right? So what will be the dimension of this set in the phase space? What will be the dimension of set Ax in the phase space?
Five.
Yeah, does everyone agree?
Yes.
The dimension of Ax will be 5. Likewise, Ay?
5.
So all of them will have dimension 5, right? So Al square, the set such that L square is equal to, and energy is the set such that you have fixed the Hamiltonian value to be some E naught. So all these sets are 5-dimensional. hypersurfaces in the phase, in the six dimensional phase space. So now, suppose we consider the intersection of the set AL square and AZ. What will be the dimension of, what are the possible dimensions of this intersection? Yeah.
That's four. There's four dimensions because I guess you have the two constraints.
Yeah, two constraints. So four is one possibility. Are there more possibilities?
Five is with.
Sorry?
Five is with.
Five. So A, both A's are five dimensional, right? Mm-hmm. And we have two. Like, we have one more constraint now. So,
yeah, I thought if the planes were parallel, but since it is an involution, that is not possible.
Yeah, I think. So, and is it possible to have less than four? We can have
other constraints in the system, like is the intersection of pi d to pi d hypersurfaces, so it should be less than pi.
Yeah. So discussing the possibilities. Of dimension for given the value of L naught square and LZ naught square. So we can fix LZ naught in this case. What will happen if I take an LZ naught value such that LZ naught square is greater than L naught square, then what will be the intersection?
Zero.
Yeah, so it will be a null space because you have to respect this constraint, right? The other possibility here, what if you take LZ naught square is equal to L naught square, sorry,
who is it? Because Alex is 0, L1 is 0, LC naught is,
yeah, so I have been thinking about it like this, I am constructing on my own, so I am also thinking, will it be three-dimensional or less than three-dimensional? So that I am not 100% sure, but what I see is that, like, if we have this condition, then we have extra conditions, right? Lx equals to 0, Ly equals to 0. That gives conditions on, more conditions on this. But how many of them are independent constraints, it will depend on that. But I would guess that it is less than equal to three dimensional. Sorry? Yeah? No, go ahead.
Did you say less or equal or more or equal?
The dimension of the hypersurface, given this constraint, the dimension of this hypersurface should be less than equal to. 3, I guess. Yeah.
Can not be 2 because we now effectively have the 4 constraints, like one for L squared, LZ, LX, and LY.
Yeah, so if all the constraints are independent, I think, then that could be the case. But I'm not 100% sure, so I'm not giving a number to that. Like, if you think about example, for example, just a sphere, and you take a plane, this is what exactly we are doing, but in a higher dimensional surface, right? So if this plane is height is greater than the radius of sphere in 3D, then the intersection is null. If this plane is tangent to here, then the intersection is just one point in 3D, right? And now you can reduce the height, and then you will get the intersection will be kind of a circle, right? In 3D, just as like, consider a 2 sphere in 3D and a plane. So what can be there? What are the possible intersections of a plane and a 2 sphere in 3-dimensional R3 basically? So the possibilities are there is no intersection, or there is intersection at just one point, if at a tangent, or the intersection leaves out a circle, right? These are circle or maybe ellipse as well, but one dimension. So overall, you can have null or one point or a 1D hypersurface in the R3. I'm trying to think of analogies that way, what should be the case, respecting all the constraints for this case. But I'm not 100% sure it. Yeah.
I was thinking maybe intuitively, if we have only the LZ component, then we restrict the motion to a 2D plane. So then there's 4 phase space dimensions. You have like X, Y, PX, PY.
And
you have an additional constraint, which is that the total angular momentum, like the LZ, is conserved. So then you get 3 dimensions.
Here you are also assuming that energy is constant, probably, because you are thinking of a physical system. Currently, I'm only dealing with here and not having any Hamilton, for example. We have the Hamilton, okay. Yeah, that could be a possibility, but overall, yeah, I'm not giving a number to this case.
How would you exactly determine the independence of the integrals of motion?
So, using some Jacobian matrix, like you can, so if suppose Fi's are your constants of motion, and then you take the Jacobian matrix del F1 by suppose like del Xi, del X, suppose del X, del F1 by del y, del f1 by del z, then del f1 by del px, del f1 by del, so like this way you go, and then you do that with the second constant of motion. So likewise, 3 constant of motion, and this is like 3 rows and 6 column matrix. I guess the rows and columns here need to be independent, like the rank. I think there should be some condition with the rank of the matrix, this matrix. So in that case, this, I don't remember the exact what should be the rank of this rectangular matrix, but there is some constant on the rank. And if that is satisfied, then.
So I can take it on face value that L squared is equal to the sum of all components squared. That means that if I fix LX, LY, and LZ, also L is fixed. And so if I have all of those constraints combined, I still, from 5 dimensions, don't go to 2, go to 3 at least, at the very least. So it's 3 or more.
Sorry, I
I mean, I can't take that equation at face value. The L squared is equal to the sum of all components of L squared.
Yeah.
And say that, okay, if Lx and Ly and Lz are fixed, then L is also fixed. And that doesn't give us a new constraint.
So that is the thing, that here when I am fixing some x naught, y, l, lx naught, ly naught, lz naught, l naught square.
What I'm saying is that
these are.
I'm saying that ax, ay, az, and al squared.
They are not.
Does not give us. Does not decrease the dimensions of these the phase space by 4. It decreases by 3 at most.
So that is where the condition of involution comes.
Yeah.
So here I am only considering these L square and LZ hypersurfaces, which are in involution.
Yeah.
So they are independent.
But
constants of motion.
Condition, the second way that you said.
Okay.
I mean,
oh, sorry. For the second condition.
LX and LY are equal to zero, but LX, LY, and LZ are not in involution because two of them give the third one.
I mean, when you do not have an involution, then there can be some trivial intersections.
Yeah, and I think
it's... But in the sense that, for example, take the case of... Take the case of simplest case of XP, which is easier to imagine. So Poisson bracket of X and P is 1, right? So now if I fix, so they are not in involution, right? X and P, these are not in involution. And if I fix X is equal to X naught, some hypersurface X is AX is a set of X comma P such that X is equal to some value X naught, and APX is equal to PX is equal to PX naught. So in that case, what is the intersection of AX and APX?
P is three dimensional?
No, just one dimension, one degree of freedom system. Suppose, I'm not giving a system. Suppose there is only one degree of freedom. I'm not giving any Hamiltonian as such, but it is one degree of freedom time independent system, suppose.
At rest, so a point in phase space.
Yeah.
But think, just if you think about it mathematically, forget about a system. You just think mathematically that if I fix x equals to a x naught and px is equal to px naught.
Zero.
So it will be in general zero, apart from the case when x naught is. Is there any case when, sorry, you said 0 or phi, null?
No.
So, yeah. So, apart from the case, is there any case when this will not be null but have some element?
Only 0.
Yeah, that's right. So, when, for specifically for this case, the intersection has one element. This is a kind of a trivial hypersurface, I would say, for specific cases of X naught and PX naught.
Yeah.
So that way, like when you were talking about LX naught equals to 0, LY naught equals to 0, I was thinking like that case may result in some trivial intersection, even when LX, LY, LZ do not commute with each other. But if I take the intersection of AX, AX, AY, AZ, I guess the case of all of them being equal to 0 will still lie in the intersection, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry, we're just trying to discuss this a bit, and I think I'm a bit confused because, like, okay, so basically the problem that we're considering is if you have maximally aligned angular momentum on the z-axis, right? Like,
yeah.
Your lz component is some lz naught, and therefore your l squared is going to be lz naught squared, right? So I was just trying to solve these, like, because it's like a system of linear, or not linear, maybe. A system of equations.
Non-linear equations, yeah.
Like set lx equal to 0, set ly equal to 0, set lz equal to lz naught.
Yeah. Right?
But it ends up being a contradiction when you actually solve the equations in the phase space variables. You end up with lz naught equals 0. And I don't know if I'm making a mistake or if I'm just... What's happening?
I think if you are dividing the variables, like in taking, if lx equals to 0, that lz equals to, lx equals to 0, that will imply ypz minus zpy.
Yeah, exactly. So this gives you like y equals zpy over pz, and then x is going to be zpx over pz, and then when you plug this back into lz equals some value, you end up with...
But physically, if you think about it, it should not be completely 0, right?
That's what,
like, yeah, so like, so some trivial solutions you might be missing out. We can discuss that later. So overall the point, so I guess I should go ahead. Overall the point of this discussion is to see, yeah.
I still think that it can't be, I don't know, maybe you agree with me, but I don't think there is even a remote chance that with the four constraints all applied, we could have a two-dimensional space, subspace. It's at least three. Would you agree with that? Because the four constraints that we have here, L, S, L, Y, L, Z, and L squared,
yeah.
We take the intersection of those four spaces.
Yeah.
The subspace is at least three-dimensional.
No, it can be. It can be. Why?
It can be
null.
Can be null.
It can be null, yeah.
But can't be two, right?
In general, so that is the thing that we are taking here, lx naught, ly naught, lz naught, and l naught square as arbitrary values.
In terms of y, x, and px, and py, and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So if lx and ly are equal to 0, you get two equations. Maybe they're trivial, maybe they're not. And if you replace LZ and L squared,
yeah,
L squared is equal to LZ squared basically, which gives this exact same,
yeah,
condition that you had but just squared.
Yeah, that is right.
So that wouldn't give any new subspace to calculate any intersections of.
Okay, so yeah, all.
So
cool.
It could be null, but I don't think it could be two.
Yeah, they all are not independent, so like we can discuss this a bit more. Like yesterday I was also thinking about it actually, what is, but I could not like explicitly solve all of them to completely say that okay, this is a number, so that's why I'm not giving a number there. So but if anyone is interested, yeah, we can discuss more what should be the dimension of the hypersurface for that specific case. Is that okay? So we discussed two cases here. So the third case is LZ naught square is less than L naught square. So in this case, it will be a 4D hypersurface. This is clear to everyone at least, right? So when the value of LZ naught square is specifically, strictly less than L naught square, then it will be a 4D hypersurface. At least we are clear about two conditions. Like first condition, when LZ naught square is greater than L naught square, then the intersection is going to be null for sure. And in this case, the intersection is going to be a four-dimensional hypersurface. Is that clear? Okay, so now if we also take the condition of then there is one more constraint, and overall so for this what are the possible dimensions of the hypersurface? Like we are increasing one more constraint, so it should be less than four dimensional at least, right? That is clear. So overall it can be null depending on the energy value and the angular momentum value. Can be null, or it can also be like 1D, 2D or 3D. So it has to be less than or equal to a 3D hypersurface. So overall the point of this exercise is that when we fix the value of L square energy and the Z component of angular momentum, just these three things, when we fix them to be some real number, the hypersurface that in the phase space that respects these three constraints will be less than equal to three-dimensional hypersurface in the six-dimensional phase space. Does that make sense? So now if we take any phase space point which is formed by these six variables that belong to this intersection, so if we can pick a phase space point that belongs to this intersection and evolve it according to the Hamiltonian with the Hamilton's equation of motion, then can anyone think about what, how to describe the dynamics? Like, will it remain on this hypersurface where we started, or can it go outside of the hypersurface? It should remain on the hypersurface, right? When we evolve, when we take any initial condition that respect these constraints, all the three constraints, and evolve it, the value of L square, Lz, and energy is going to be constant throughout the trajectory of that initial condition. So it is going to remain on this hypersurface. So the trajectory is restricted to the three-dimensional hypersurface defined by this condition. Dynamics will be restricted to this hypersurface. So now I think we were talking, like I had just stated these involution condition last year. So I would suppose that if we try to, in addition to this, if I just try to add an intersection of AX, for example, I think that will imply that there may not exist an intersection. Like the intersecting surface overall, this plus this may be null. So the intersection isn't guaranteed. But when we take constants of motion which are in involution, then non-trivial intersections are kind of guaranteed for some values. It may not exist for all values, but there will exist some non-trivial intersections. But when you also consider constants of motion which are not in involution, then non-trivial intersecting surfaces are not guaranteed. The existence is not guaranteed. So that is what I think is the significance of involution condition in the definition of integrability in the Liouville sense.
Is it guaranteed that the two hypersurfaces will necessarily not intersect if the constants are not in involution?
So I gave the example of x and px, right? So if your, for example, if your system has that, then your intersection is supposed to be a trivial intersection, which is the specific case of zero. Apart from that, it is null. So just extrapolating for that, from that, I'm just thinking that that could be the possibility.
I couldn't understand there why it's null, because x equal to x naught is a vertical line and px equal to px naught is a horizontal line.
No, if you think about it physically, that what is momentum? It is rate of change of position, right? And if you fix position, then px naught should be zero, right? That is only like the momentum is supposed to be zero. Or if you fix momentum, then position can't be a fixed number apart from when position and momentum both are zero.
Px naught has to be zero, but x naught can be anything.
Okay, yeah, sorry. So I probably missed that point. So there might be some more trivial cases where one of the quantities is fixed to be zero. So x can be x naught. I should probably change x to some real number, x naught. And then once you fix x naught, then momentum is zero. So that is so you can't fix your momentum value to some arbitrary number. So for, I mean, I just termed these kind of cases to be some trivial cases where at least one of the quantities has to be zero.
This is kind of confusing to me, because here you're basically using, in the Lagrangian picture, you're using dl over dx dot is px. And so you're using another equation to find the connection between p and x, and saying that if px is zero, that gives us, well, if L is, let's say, m over 2 times x dot squared, so x dot is 0 whenever px is 0. And we're saying that if you start at whatever x naught, if px is 0, it does satisfy, it is in that hypersurface, let's say.
Yeah.
In that subspace. So I think there is also another equation involved here, because if you just take x and p on face value, make such assumptions.
Yeah, that is right. So I think maybe we cannot come with a Hamiltonian where x and px both are constants of motion simultaneously, right? Even though they are not in involution, but maybe we cannot have probably a system where position and momentum are both constants of motion simultaneously. So in that case, it might not imply a physical system that way.
I have a question for the case with LZ zero scale is LZ scale. If it think,
LZ, what?
LZ zero scale, the second case.
Yeah.
If you think an action angle is a coordinate
system, yeah,
I think it would be boundary of the fourth dimension space.
Yeah, you. So you go from, so the, So in general, it is a 4D hypersurface, right? And the boundary, yeah, that is a very good point, I guess, that the boundary, that condition should be the boundary. So that will probably be a three-dimensional hypersurface, I guess. That is the most likely answer then. So everyone understands his point. So what he is saying that, like, if you suppose you take a spherical volume of filled ball, for example, in R3, what is the dimension of the boundary of the ball? It is two-dimensional. But if you take everything inside the ball also, it is three-dimensional. But if you only take the boundary, it is two-dimensional. So if you have any set, continuous set, for example, in a phase space, then the boundary of the set will probably be one less dimension than the dimension of the whole set itself.
That was an argument for?
For LZ equals to LZ nod case.
Is three-dimensional?
I mean, yeah, that's so LZ equals to LZ nod case is the boundary of this case. Like, this can be an open 4D hypersurface, and the boundary is like a 3D hypersurface of that. So I think that argument is most likely correct. So now coming to the frequencies of the system, like last day in the end, I was just writing some equations from notes of David, that if the system is integrable, then there exists an action angle variable formalism where these conditions hold. Like, this is like equation 2.74 in his I'm not going into the details of action angle variable formalism here because, yeah, we do not have time to do that. So if you take this, that for the case of integrable systems, the Hamiltonian, there exists a canonical transformation such that the Hamiltonian is only functions of some action variables and not angle variables, or I can say. So in that case, if Hamiltonian is only a function of action variables and not angle variables, then the equation of motion for the action variables becomes zero, and for the angle variables, it is so. This is a so since Fj's are constants of motion, these omega i's are constants in time. So the solution is Fit is equal to Fi0 and Iit is equal to Psi i0 plus omega I t. We can see, yeah.
Sorry, I'm a little confused on the notation. There, it looks like F sub I and then I on top as well. Is that?
Oh, yeah, sorry. It's just F sub I and there is a dot here.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
My bad. So here you can see that action variables are constants in time, and angle variables evolve with a frequency fixed by the constants of motion in the system, basically. So these are constants in time because your constants of motion in the systems are constants as well, right? They don't change. So overall, every hypersurface fixed by the value of the constants of motion has n number of frequencies associated to it. And these frequencies are constant in time. So overall, the thing is, when we fix the value of the constants of motion in a system, the hypersurface gets fixed. It is less than or equal to n-dimensional hypersurface. And the frequency of the hypersurface also gets fixed. So there are n frequencies corresponding to the hypersurface.
I'm sorry, I was confused. I'm confused a little bit. Where did the equation for psi dot come from? I'm not talking about the Poisson bracket, the DHT phi. Is that a definition?
So these are Hamilton's equation of motion, right? So, like, Hamilton's equation of motion is like pi dot is equal to minus del h by del qi.
Oh.
And qi dot is equal to del h by del pi. And you can show that this equals Poisson bracket of h and p, and this equals to the Poisson bracket of h and q. So this comes from there. So like this is some other canonical transformation in action angle variable formalism, so which also respects this Hamilton's equation of motion, right? Now we'll discuss what a resonant theory. Like we have n, so given actions, suppose I denote actions by J here, in integrable systems, I am still talking about integrable system, given n actions, the torus formed, like the hypersurface torus, or the hypersurface is called resonant. If summation over ki omega I, or omega I's are functions of these, is equal to 0, where ki's are non-zero integers. So then it is called rational tori, in the sense that resonant, or sometimes it is also called rational tori. So if you suppose you take just two frequencies, omega 1, omega 2, and calculate the ratio. If it is a rational number, then such a condition can be constructed, in the sense that suppose this is some k1 by k2. So this will imply omega 1 k2 minus k1 omega 2 is 0, right? And k1 and k2 should be non-zero. On the other hand, this ratio can be an irrational number as well. And in the case the ratio is a rational number, then it is non-resonant. So I'll give an example for it. And so there can be there for n degrees of freedom system integrable, there will be n frequencies. So either you can say that pairwise their ratio is a rational number, or you can use this condition that k1 omega 1 plus k2 omega 2 plus k3 omega 3 is, yeah.
Sorry, I'm a little confused. First of all, what's the open parentheses?
These are these are FIs here basically.
And when you say actions, which type of action are you referring to? Are you referring to
So overall, the thing is, if your system is integrable, then there exists a canonical transformation to an action angle variable formalism where this equation of motion holds. The action variables do not evolve and angle variables evolve in this way.
Okay, and what does it have to do with the torus specifically?
So in this case, the angle variable evolves with a fixed frequency, right?
Yes.
So the n-dimensional hypersurface that we talked about in integrable system is endowed with n frequencies.
Yes.
And it is kind of, the hypersurface is kind of isomorphic to an n-torus. And we are, David has mentioned that in his lecture notes. I'm not going into the details of that. But it is isomorphic to an n torus, so that's why we call it a tori basically.
Okay, is that because it has n frequency, so it's n waves of
Yeah, that is right. Okay. So for two torus, for example, there are two ways.
Yeah. Okay, that makes sense.
So that's how you can go to or three torus. Three frequencies associated. So I'll use an example. So I'll give an example for the resonant tori. So in tutorial, we studied the kicked rotor system, right? You remember, in tutorial we studied the kicked rotor system, which was L equals to L square by 2i plus k cos theta. This was question number 2, it is related to the standard map. No worries if you did not get to question 2. So this was the kicked rotor, which is a periodically kicked system basically. And the phase space here will be of this system will be like a cylinder, because theta is angular and the angular momentum can be a real number. The phase space is like cylinder here. So for the case of k equals to 0, is the system integrable or non-integrable? Yeah, right, because the Hamiltonian is a constant of motion and there is only one degree of freedom here. So we can solve the Hamilton's equation of motion for this case. So L dot equals to minus del H by del theta is equal, and this implies is equal to 0. Since for k, we are solving for k equals to 0 case. So L dot will be 0, and this will imply L is a constant of motion, which we can set it to some value L naught. And theta naught is equal to del H by del L, that is equal to L by I. So theta you can trivially integrate it to. So can anyone tell what is the frequency here for k equals to 0? So the frequency is L naught over I, right? So overall, you can see that the frequency here, if I and suppose I take I equals to 1, suppose for simplicity, the frequency can be an irrational value or a rational value, right? It depends on what L naught we have chosen. If we choose L naught equals to root 2 or pi, the frequency of the system is going to be irrational. And if we choose L naught equals to 1 or 2, the frequency is rational. Suppose I take a system of two rotors, uncoupled, and I is just, I'm taking to be 1 for simplicity. So, and you can solve that. Is this integrable? If I take two uncoupled rotors without any kick?
Yes.
L1 and L2 both will be constants of motion. The two constants of motion, which are in involution if you calculate. So now, and the frequencies, the corresponding frequencies will be L omega 1 is L1 naught and omega 2 is the, these are the two frequencies, whatever initial value of the L value we fix, it will remain there. So let us just consider a few examples. The motion will happen on two torus here, right? Can anyone say which of them, which of these four are resonant tori? Like I have just written, these are just pairs, omega 1 comma omega 2.
First and third.
Yeah, that is right. So
what is the significance of the tori being resonant?
Yeah, so I'm getting to that. So you understand what we mean by resonant tori, right? So next the question is, if we employ a perturbation, a weak perturbation to integrable system, suppose you have a system which is integrable, that will imply that you can express the Hamiltonian in terms of action variables only. Suppose you have n degree of freedom system which is integrable. Now if I consider, add a weak perturbation to it, the perturbed Hamiltonian can be a function of all the so suppose I consider a new Hamiltonian which is H. And generically, it will be function of all the action and all the angle variables. This is weakly perturbed. From the integrable system. And the perturbed Hamiltonian is a function of all the variables, not just action variables, and this is the strength of perturbation, epsilon. So it is a weakly perturbed system. You do this all the time, right? For example, even in the solar system, most of the computations that are done is using, like, you construct a two-body problem, you study that analytically, we know it, and the solutions analytically. Now you add a third test mass, which is very small. So it will perturb the gravitational potential very weakly, right? Overall of the system. So that's how it is done. So that is one example. Suppose we do that. So in this case, like the J1 to Jn are constants of motion for the integrable system, right? But if we consider this perturbed system, are they, will they still be constants of motion or not? Right? So yeah, they won't be, in general, they won't be constants of motion. So now, if I start with any initial condition which was on the hypersurface, n-dimensional hypersurface of the 2n-dimensional phase space for H naught, and if we perturb, if we evolve that initial condition, will it in general stay on that hypersurface or will not stay on that hypersurface? It may not stay because these are no longer these action variables are no longer constants of motion. So in general, like the hypersurface will start getting destroyed once you add perturbations to the system. The hypersurface will start getting destroyed. So the motion is no longer restricted to that n-dimensional hypersurface. So here comes, the theorem called Cam theorem. The three scientists, this is after the name of three scientists, Kolmogorov, Arnold, Mosier. So Kolmogorov gave this theorem in 1954 without proof. And then Arnold and Mosier proved it separately in 1960s independently. So the Cam theorem, according to the Cam theorem, it says that the most of the non-resonant tori, they survive the perturbation, small perturbation, weak enough perturbation, not strong perturbations. But if your perturbation is weak enough and it satisfies some conditions, then most of the non-resonant tori, for example, this tori, if I add a coupling here, such that n1, n2 will not be a constant of motion here, then for example, these two are non-resonant tori and these two are resonant. So these two tori will survive the perturbations. The hypersurface will get slightly deformed, but it will survive the perturbations. So you can use perturbation theory to explain the dynamics of those initial conditions which lie on a non-resonant tori. On the other hand, resonant tori will get destroyed. The initial conditions will no longer be restricted to the n-dimensional hypersurface at all. So that is the idea of Cam theorem. Yeah.
They will survive the perturbations. Are we implying that the constants of motions are the same or similar, like bounded to the?
So now when you have the perturbed system, then there are no longer generic constants of motion in the system. Locally, you may have constants of motion, like if you just restrict yourself to a small space in the phase space, then you may have some constants of motion. But for integrable system, you have global constants of motion for the system. For non-integrable systems, you may have constants of motion locally, valid locally for some initial conditions, but you may not have it generically for whole phase space. So that is the system, that is the thing. Locally, these may be constants or may not be constant. But for example, like if you remember, so for this case, for the case of kicked rotor, like for k equals to 0, if you plot the standard map for k equals to 0, this is just, these will be straight lines for k equals to 0. And the frequency of each of the line is going to be 0. But if you would have seen in your calculations that for k not equals to 0, but very small, say k 0.1, the tori goes something like this. Like they are still kind of straight lines, but slightly deformed straight lines. That's what we saw there. It is, so the kicked rotor is a non-integrable system, and this is what happens, except for some, where if you go, you will and look at your dynamics, there will small ellipses will start to appear near some of the tori. But for most of the tori, you will see that they are just lines. you can go ahead and just, I had sent the code in via email. You can go ahead and do that, like, do the coding and see, change k value and see how it changes. So for small values, k equals to 0.1, 0.2, you will see it is a small perturbation. So this is what will happen. As you go on increasing k value, more and more, so these tori have a, this are some resonant tori's are there, and they are already destroyed even for very small perturbations. Like this dynamics, you cannot explain as a perturbation to the straight line, right? You can explain probably this dynamics, you can explain using a perturbation to this, but the dynamics here, these elliptical kind of behavior, you cannot explain using perturbation. There is a qualitative change in the dynamics rather than a quantitative change. This to this is a quantitative change, vaguely, but this to this is a qualitative change. So resonant tori undergoes qualitative changes, but non-resonant tori only goes some quantitative change for weak enough perturbations, given that the Hamiltonian satisfies some standard conditions. And then when you go on increasing the strength of the perturbation, even the non-resonant tori slowly start to break up and lead to some chaotic behavior. So when you increased k, you would have seen in your numerics that it is starting to become more and more chaotic. The regular islands are starting to shrink, right?
Sorry, I didn't quite understand. What was the mathematical reason for the fact that resonant tori break up easier than non-resonant?
So the difference between behavior on resonant tori and non-resonant tori is, on resonant tori, you have these periodic behavior for integrable system, but on non-resonant tori, you have quasi-periodic behavior. So, yeah.
And in the non-periodic behavior, do the orbits, are the orbits dense in the whole phase space? In the non-periodic case, are they, like, will, because in that diagrams we saw, like, our, in the chaotic case, the orbits in the phase space covered all the phase space and it seemed...
But that happens only for very, very large k values, right? That small one initial condition, for example, for k equals to 7 covers the whole phase space upon evolution. That doesn't happen for even the chaotic cases for small values, like k equals to... You can see some chaotic behavior, like there is unstable unstable periodic unstable fixed point, I guess 0, 0 or 0 pi, one of them is unstable. I guess 0, 0 is unstable. So around the fixed point 0, 0 here, you can see that there is a divergence of initial closely spaced initial conditions, but it doesn't spread in the whole phase space. But in the, as you go on increasing k value, even the non-resonant tori start to break, and then there are several unstable fixed points that have arisen out of qualitative changes in the system, and that changes the behavior of the system completely and it becomes chaotic. But there is another thing. This, so your question is very, very interesting, and you can look up Arnold diffusion. So what happens when the degree of freedom of the system is more than 2? So for degree of freedom, if the system has degree of freedom more than 2, then there is Arnold diffusion, and the evolution of the initial conditions can be dense. So I had thought to briefly describe that, but unfortunately I don't have time to do that. But there is a qualitative difference between systems with degree of freedom less than are equal to 2 versus systems with degree of freedom greater than 2, time independent systems. So like there, when you perturb the system, what happens? When you perturb an integrable system, what happens? So there is a qualitative difference. So I did not get to, I think time is almost over. I did not get to explicitly write the CAM theorem.
Okay.
but it is written in, I guess, David's note briefly. Yeah.
Because the motion is quasi-periodic and non-resonant.
Right, yeah.
It's not as sensitive to perturbation of Y.
That, yeah, like I have not gone into the proof of CAM theorem. I guess it is a very complicated theorem, which like, yeah, very, it has probably very tedious proof. So I have not gone into the details yet why that happens, but that is one of the reasons.
So for integrable systems in general, it's like all of them are more or less the same. If we can parameterize the phase space with the torus. And my question related to this is, how can we see the rest, like all the symmetries of a physical system, if it is integrable in the phase space, if it will always be, if you will always be able to reduce it to an n torus? Because I think that I'm not understanding something, because in the central problem, we have like an SO3 symmetry.
Okay.
And since it is integrable, we will see that its phase space will be a 3 torus. But I thought that it would, that because of symmetry, it would be something like a 3 sphere. So I
it is isomorphic to a 3 torus, I would say. Like whatever hypersurface you get, you should be able to isomorphically make an isomorphic transformation to an n torus.
Yes, but
SO3
is not a symmetry of a 3 torus. So
okay,
you are,
yeah,
breaking the symmetry somehow to like S1, 3 S1s, which is smaller, isn't it?
I think it will be in configuration space, like in phase space, we might get.
Yeah, that is a good point, I guess. Maybe. We can discuss it more later.
Sorry, the resonant toroid after the perturbation, do they become non-resonant or completely get destroyed?
They get destroyed. Okay. Under suffix. So the other thing is that in the actual proof of CAM theorem, the epsilon values, the strength of the perturbation taken is extremely small. But in numerical thing, like numerics, people have observed that the non-resonant tori survive a higher value of perturbation strength. So the exact value of that, I guess, is not known completely. But I do not think that the behavior will change like that, resonant to non-resonant, because whether a tori is resonant or not is coming from the integrable system, which is perturbed, right? So yeah.
Is there any condition of the type on the type of perturbation, like any H1 shouldn't be capable of like completely destroying the system?
Yeah, so there are a couple of conditions actually on that the frequencies of the unperturbed systems should be functionally independent of each other, and the H0 should satisfy a non-degeneracy condition. And the H1, yeah, the perturbed Hamiltonian should have sufficient number of derivatives. So it should be smooth to a good extent, like maybe not C infinity, like kind of functions, which are like infinitely differentiable. But I think I have read that it needs to be sufficiently smooth. It should have a good number of, yeah, the derivative should be a valid function.
Any smooth perturbation can destroy it.
I'm sorry?
That's strange that any smooth perturbation can destroy the, like...
Some tori, not all.
Not all, yeah.
Yeah, so some tori can be destroyed. Not all the destroy. All. And yeah, there is a famous problem called the problems of small determinators. So if you go and look into in the 12th chapter of Goldstein, this problem has been described, the problem of small denominators. So using perturbation theory, they have shown how to use perturbation theory to solve a perturbed Hamiltonian from an integrable system. And when does the solution fail? why does it fail? So they explicitly show that when the Torii is resonant, that is when the frequencies satisfy this condition, when the frequencies satisfy the condition, where did I write it? Yeah, the condition there, then the perturbation, in the perturbation theory, the correction terms can be large. Like overall, when you apply perturbation theory, you want correction terms to be small, right? But when the, for resonant Torii, the correction terms are very large. So, and that is a very well-known problem in classical physics, which is in astronomy and stuff. I like celestial bodies, study of celestial bodies. This is a very well-known problem for centuries, the problem of small denominator. Okay, the class is, over. Thank you all, everyone. So if you have any questions, I am here to answer. But yeah, the class is officially over, so you can leave.